Welcome to the Pendle Hidden Gems podcast, recorded at Pendle Yesub in Nelson.
In this podcast, we are featured with Dwa, Zainab, Callum, Sully, Sean, Aaron, Mevish, and Saud.
Welcome to the podcast that delves deep into the rich tapestry stories and mystery murders of Lancashire. My name is Saida Dua Zainab. In this segment, we journey to the serene village of Cuemo, located just east of Lancaster, to explore a remarkable archaeological discovery that windows into the Dark Ages. The discovery. Our story begins in 1973, during the construction of a car park near the Jubilee Tower, a prominent landmark erected in 1887 to commemorate Queen Victoria's Jubilee. As workers excavated an area, a local man named James Marshall noticed a particular wooden object from the soil, initially mistaken for a canoe, but further examination showed otherwise. The Lancaster City Museum revealed that it had been a hollow-out oak coffin dated back to approximately 1,350 years to the early medieval period. The coffin and its contents. The coffin crafted from a single oak trunk and pegged together in two halves contained a delicate remain of its occupant. While the peat had decomposed the bones, resilient materials like hair, fingernails, and toenails remained, offering a connection to the individuals. The body had been wrapped in a wooden shroud, notable for being one of the largest pieces of fabric from the era discovered in the UK. Interestingly, the shroud was slightly undersized, leading those who prepared the burial to cut the corner piece to wrap around the feet separately. The significance of the burial. Radiocarbon dating places the burial between 600 and 780, the period often referred to as the Dark Ages, due to its scarcity of written records. Similar boat-shaped oak coffins from this era have been found, suggesting a regional burial practice among early Saxon communications. The choice of an oak coffin resembling a dugout canoe may hold symbolic significance, possibly reflecting beliefs about the journey to the afterlife. The landscape of Cuemo. Cuemo is nestled within the forest of Boland. It's an area out of standing natural beauty. The village name derives from Old English and Old Norse meaning mills on the moor, indicative of its historical significance in the milling. The milestone grit quarried from nearby slope. The landscape is characterized by rolling hills, lush greenery, and panoramic views. This serene and remote setting provides a fitting backdrop for an ancient burial site. Visiting the site today, visitors of the Jubilee Tower can not only enjoy breathtaking visits, but also reflect on the area's rich and its story. When we think about the Cuemo Bog, it's not something to think about in a sad kind of way. It's more to think about its history and how people would think of the afterlife and how it affected others. Now, after doing research on Cuemo, I've noticed that not many people were very happy about the burial itself, knowing that how many bodies could be underneath all of that peat mud. Now, if we think about it, back in the Dark Ages, who knew how people thought about the journey to the afterlife? This site is not only a historical landmark, but it also contains spiritual significance.
Mera naam Saida Dua Zainab hai, aur shukriya aapko mere saath is safar pe aane ka.
So what, after reading that now, how do you feel after reading that?
What they call the bog itself is very, I don't know, like you can say it's kind of ancient and it has a lot of history to it. Like how, you don't know how many other bodies have been, I guess you can say, buried in that, probably decomposed or anything like that. They only noticed the coffin itself because of the canoe, like canoe looking thing, I guess. But if we dig a bit deeper, how many more bodies are you going to find? How many people do you think have been buried there that nobody knows about?
Hi, I'm Zainab. I would like to discuss the Pendle Radicals and a little about C.L.R. James and his connection to Nelson. James was a lifelong critic of colonialism, capitalism, and racial oppression. His activism spanned continents and connected black liberation with global working class struggles. His book, The Black Jacobins, linked the Haitian Revolution to broader struggles against colonial rule, and he influenced leaders like Eric Williams, the first Prime Minister of Trinidad and Tobago. He worked with Kwame Nkrumah to support African self-rule and unity, and also advocated for worker-led socialist revolutions and challenged both Western capitalism and Stalinism. His ideas influenced figures like Malcolm X and the Black Panther Party. His book Beyond a Boundary used cricket to explore class, race, and imperialism. James's ideas were shaped by key historical events, political ideologies, and personal experiences. Growing up in colonial Trinidad inspired his fight for Caribbean independence. He saw the Russian Revolution as proof that working people could overthrow oppressive systems. James later reflected that his time in Nelson had a more significant impact on his writing than his experience in London's Bloomsbury. Today, the house on Meredith Street, where James lodged, bears a blue plaque honouring Larry Constantine. This location is featured on the Wonder Women walking route, part of the Pendle Radicals project, which explores the area's rich history of radical thinkers and activists. Pendle has a long tradition of activism from 17th century witch trials to 20th century labour and civil rights movements. The Pendle Radicals project highlights this legacy by uncovering the stories of local changemakers, including the Chartist movement, trade union roots, and women's suffrage.
What kind of activism did he do?
He was a historian, writer, so his main book that he wrote was The Black Jacobins. So that focused on Le Viteur, who was kind of the main revolutionary leader of the Haitian Revolution.
What made him decide to do it, you know, be a radical?
So he was born in Trinidad, which is a Caribbean island. So Haiti was a large plantation colony. So they produced a lot of sugar and different kind of products for the British Empire. And he was mainly self-educated, so his family, his mother, I think, had a library, so he would read a lot about history, colonial history, and that kind of inspired him to kind of learn a bit more and, yeah, get into that in an academic, in the academic field. The Haitian Revolution was the biggest, slave revolt in history. So during the revolution, there was a huge amount of slaves on the island. About 95 almost percent of the population were enslaved people. There was kind of mixed race people, so they had more rights than the black enslaved people. It was also during the French Revolution. During the French Revolution, it was written in the new constitution that everyone had kind of human rights. So the mixed race and white population also wanted to fight for this in Haiti as well. So that kind of pushed the political change. And then, yeah, there was the black enslaved population picked this up and kind of revolted.
So one of the things that's always fascinated me about C.L.R. James is the idea of him coming from Trinidad and ending up in this landscape, you know, in a kind of East Lanx mill town, looking out at the hills, looking out at Pendle, that view that we all know and love. You know, what was life like for C.L.R. James in this place? Did he encounter racism?
He did encounter racism, but I feel like what I got from this research and looking into the Pendle Radicals was how he was welcomed. He was by his friend. And the pride that people have of the history of him being here and that he was welcome here. So that's kind of what I took from like the Pendle Radicals.
So I'm Aaron, and this is the tale of the Pendle Witch Trials. So In August 1612, at least 21 men and women were in custody in Lancaster Castle on charges of witchcraft. We'll go into what life was like in Lancashire in 1612. So, King James was on the throne. He was a Scottish king. It was his first time in England. But he'd had it drilled into him since he was a kid that witchcraft was all around him. He was massive about witchcraft. I think Shakespeare wrote Macbeth for him. So before 1612, we'd already had the gunpowder plot. So King James, bit paranoid at this point, always thinking, yeah, people are out to get me. Then you get up here and it's, you know, we've got these rolling hills, these deep valleys, this weather that is just awful. You'd naturally think, oh, this is where the devil lives. So this all really kicked off on the 18th of March, 1612, when Alison Devis, a young girl, young beggar girl, was out walking along the Colne Road when she came across John Law, a peddler from Halifax. Now, Alison wanted to buy some pins from him. Pins were used in different herbalism rituals, different things that could be seen as witchcraft. But because she looked like a beggar, John Law didn't want to open his pack for her. So he just carried on walking. But then, as he's carried on walking, he collapses in the middle of the road. Alison thinks she's cursed him. In reality, the guy's just had a stroke, but he gets taken to, I think, a house in Colne, and then his son gets involved, and he's in uproar, and he says something needs to be done about these witches in the area. Now, Alison came from a family that was quite poor. They were living in a place called Malkin Tower, which, in the old language, Malkin meant something along the lines of shit. So they were living in literal shit tower. But they were this poor family, this beggar family, living on someone else's land. The matriarch of the family was Elizabeth Southerns, also known as Mother Demdike. And she had a daughter called Elizabeth, who married a guy called John Devis. He died years ago. But with John, Elizabeth had Alison, James, and Janet. Now, Mother Demdike also had an illegitimate son called Christopher, who also lived in Pendle. Now, there had been reports for ages of different magic going on. And one of these meetings was a meeting at Malkin Tower. So on Good Friday, 6th of April, Elizabeth Devis had called together a meeting at Malkin Tower of friends and families. And it was said that they were meeting in accordance to a great festival. So in the trial, it was related how Mother Demdike had been called by John Nutter of Bullhole Farm in Pendle to cure a sick cow. But despite Demdike's ministrations, the cow died. This was seen as she'd bewitched the cow. This was a time that if you had land, you had money. If you didn't have money, you were begging and you were living on other people's land, just trying to get by. One of the witches that was convicted was Alice Nutter. And she was from, I think, Rough Lee. But she was a landowner. But she had beef with this guy called Knowles, was his name. And he was a magistrate. Roger Knoll. But I think they had sort of beef about money and about the land. So Roger Knoll, being this magistrate that probably thought himself quite a big influential figure, really wanted to do something about... He really wanted to get back at Alice Nutter.
So you talking about like witches and all that stuff here. So what does it mean, like you think to yourself that can we see witches at night time or can't we see them? So like what's the meaning for behind? Because you know me, when people say that, oh, we see shadows at night time. Let's say for example we see shadows. It's not really shadows, it's like fake shadows. Oh yeah, I'm scared of my own shadow. That's how it is, you know what I mean?
So the thing with these witches is they weren't really witches. Demdike was in her 80s in 1612, which at the time, the average life expectancy was about 30, 40 years. So to get to that age, you'd have to have some sort of magic about you. All she was a herbalist, most likely, which is you use different plants and different herbs to create medicine. And that still goes on today. That's how we've got modern pharmaceuticals. But the word witch actually comes from the Old English witter, which means wise ones. Nice. So in a community, the wise ones would be the lawyers, they would be the doctors, they'd be the fortune tellers, and so they would really hold the community together. But as you start seeing the influx of Christianity from Europe around the 700s, you start seeing that pagan persecution. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden, these people that are really wise people, really knowledgeable people that benefit the community, as you get this rival religion coming in, you start seeing that phasing out and being sort of bastardised and turned against.
I have a question. Do you think that any of the Pendle witches could have potentially been either pagan or Wiccan or some other religion that was originally indigenous to England in that specific area?
I think they most likely would have been Catholics. Mm-hmm. They would have been known as followers of the old religion. But at the time, England had just become Protestant with King James, so there was very much an anti-Catholic sentiment. The word pagan actually comes from the Latin pagani, meaning someone that lives in the country. And it was seen that if you lived in the towns, you were more likely to be Christian, you were more likely to follow the trends. If you lived outside of town, you were out of fashion. You were, you know, last season's trends. So if you were still Catholic, then you were sort of against the new way of life.
Are you trying to say that most of the stories about the Pendle witches, most of them weren't really witches, they were just allegations?
Yeah, absolutely. It was very much a patriarchal world. In fact, it still is. But because these women were poor, they were beggars, they were easy people to frame. And so if there is a chance that this person is magic and coinciding with the devil, you know, it's real easy to just bin them off.
Could you tell us a little bit about the actual conviction and how they got from here on this side of Pendle Hill across Bowland to Lancaster Castle and the jail?
Yeah, and it all comes back to that meeting at Malkin Tower. So everybody that had been involved in that was rounded up and carted over to Lancaster Castle. And I'll tell you a little passage from the trial of Elizabeth Devis, the mother of Jennet. So I'm reading from a book called The Pendle Witch Trial by Rachel A.C. Hasted. It's a fantastic book. It goes into a load of detail. So the prosecution presented Elizabeth as the most dangerous and evil character after Demdike, her mother. The charge against her was the murder of John Robinson, alias Swire, by witchcraft, which she denied. Noel presented what he claimed was Elizabeth's own voluntary confession made in April, which, however, Elizabeth had the good sense to deny. That confession in April was essentially Elizabeth admitting, yeah, I have all this ancient knowledge of wisdom that can help with herbalism and healing, but obviously that didn't work well for her. The prosecution then introduced its star witness, 9-year-old Jennet Devis, to testify against her own mother. Elizabeth cried out against the child in such a fearful manner that Jennet was reduced to tears and said she could not speak in the presence of her mother. After Elizabeth was removed, Jennet was then stood on a table in the middle of the court to say her piece. Jennet said that she believed her mother had been a witch for 3 or 4 years. She had a familiar called Baal, who was in the shape of a brown dog, and Jennet had witnessed conversations between Baal and her mother on 3 occasions. So essentially, you've got a 9-year-old child that has just condemned her own mother as a witch. King James had written a book called Demonology, and that highlighted all the ways that you could possibly catch a witch. And it said, in a case where you're trialing a possible witch, women, beggars, and children were acceptable witnesses. Yeah, baffling.
I have a question. You mentioned about how during the witch trials and other stuff similar to it that happened in that time period, do you think that when the Anglo-Saxons colonised and started to conquer the Celtic people, who was, of course, native to all the British Isles, do you think that played a part in it? And do you think that the Anglo-Saxons colonising us, do you think that played a part in contributing to the persecution of so-called witches and people who they believed to be witches?
In my own view, not particularly, because the Anglo-Saxons themselves were pagan. You had the Viking influence, so you had that North mythology. You had the Picts, you had all these different polytheistic religions going on at the same time. It's only when you really start to get that influx of the monotheistic religions that it starts becoming an issue. And when you get that really sort of that competition with God, that anything that isn't God is the devil and devil worship. But the pagans never believed in the devil.
So everything is true, yeah, but why is it still happening nowadays from thousands of years ago? Why does it still keep on happening?
I think what it really is if you think back then, they were just women with...
100%.
Women who were just wise, and they were just smart people.
Yeah.
But then when you get God coming into it, you can't have someone that's more knowledgeable than God.
No,
on a positive note, a couple years ago, the charges against all involved were, I think, overturned. So, you know, that is the actual law now saying these people involved were innocent and were put through a completely unjust system. I mean, having a 9-year-old testify against their own mother is absolutely shocking.
So to bounce off what Sully said, how do you feel the persecution of back then in the witch trials compares to today, in a sense?
It all comes back to dogma and being so hardline in a dogma that you lose the empathy for other people and you can't see it from other people's perspectives. We know that Old Mother Demdike was 80 at the time, which means she had to have some sort of knowledge on medicine so that she could keep herself healthy. Some Puritan at the time would have seen that and seen it as witchcraft. But now you've still got all these holistic healers that are saying, oh, you don't want to go with Big Pharma. And it's finding the mix of what is actual scientific fact and what is just dogmatic opinion. And I think it's really finding a healthy balance between those two things.
But just following up on that discussion, I mean, Callum asked, you know, how does this persecution resonate with what's going on today? I think violence against women is an endemic. It's present in our society. 1 in 4 women or girls will be affected by domestic abuse at some point in their life. I think what happened then with the persecution of women is it's present today. Unless our government, our society changes, you know, those entrenched views of women, I mean, this is something that it's not only affected women in the UK, but it's affecting women worldwide. I mean, chiming in on the discussion that Sully had, I think it's sort of those old traditional cultural views that, you know, sort of accuse women of being in control of what's unseen, the unseen powers. I think if work isn't done to undo that thinking, undo that cultural sort of like those schools of thought, then women will always be... you know, vulnerable to persecution, vulnerable to violence. And I think it needs to stop in all forms of society.
Yeah, I feel like in modern days, men can feel like they're losing power, and then they do tend to lean onto like right wing or like, you know, try and target or gaslight minorities, whether that's like migrants, trans people, Muslims. So it's definitely important to try and understand maybe where they're coming from and really try and get to the source of like the issues, to try and like combat that.
Basically, I 100% agree that in like cultures nowadays, the violence and abuse against women, because I feel like I'm taking this in the psychological way into this, okay? But I feel like when, no offense to any men at all completely, but when men kind of feel like they're losing control, they psychologically take their emotions into a way to, like, they kind of push it towards violence and abuse. And if you've kind of, I don't know, if you've heard about the news and stuff, it's especially because they feel like they have, like, the upper hand. They're supposed to be the person who's in charge. But once they see that, obviously, women are taking over, they're not really taking over either. It's just, for women, I feel like it's more, they experience things within a home, within, like, a family and stuff like that. They experience more. So in that aspect, they are much wiser. And that itself, it bothers like men and like the monarchy as well. Like if you notice that even in our like parliament of house, like our house of parliament, they are majority, most decisions are made by men. Even when we had the queen and everything, most decisions are made by men. And when women try to kind of take a stand, and this is like a double thing, like I'm about to say, but things like what happened to Princess Diana kind of does happen. Obviously there's like the whole two ways on how people think about it, but as like a personal opinion, I feel like since she tried to take a stand as a woman, it kind of backfired on her and she was like killed. R.I.P.
Last question for marriage is that everyone's right. We all have a voice. We have a voice. It's very important we use our voice in the right way. Look at Parliament, for example, now. Whatever she's saying is true. Look at Parliament. Women should take stand. Because whatever women got a right to believe, they should believe it. Whatever want to say, they can say it. They got a voice. Because it's like you say to a person that you got a voice.
I would like to say that I do have complete solidarity with trans people, non-binary people, of course, women. And I think that the big problem is that women have been so oppressed by men for so long, and trans people and non-binary people have been oppressed by cisgender people, and migrants are folks being oppressed. I think the biggest problem is that when these groups are oppressed, I think that what bigots are afraid of is they think that when they're asking for equal rights, they see that as them asking for more rights. So they're thinking that if we have rights and we get more rights than them, when in reality, like, what we want, we just want a society where everybody has equality and everybody has equal opportunities and everybody is able to coexist and express their own opinions equally, and a society without any oppression towards any minority groups of any kind, whether that be women, whether that be women in general being oppressed anyway, or whether that be minority groups like trans people, non-binary people, migrants, migrant workers, or just people who come to visit here but then will unfortunately have racial abuse and virtually anything else, you know what I mean? It's that I personally would love to see a society where everybody has equal opportunities and is able to coexist and have equality.
It reminds me so much of what Zainab was telling us about C.L.R. James and those kind of, you know, histories of fighting for equality and the kind of, radicalism away from systems of oppression. And I think what's absolutely beautiful for me, listening to you guys talk so eloquently, talk so intelligently and with such emotional kind of breadth, is that all these stories are centred on here, on Pendle and on Nelson, and they're kind of rippling out across the world.
The unsolved murder of Mohammed Arif. Mohammed Arif, an 18-year-old Pakistani national, was brutally attacked in Nelson in January 1980, resulting in his death from serious head injuries after being taken to the hospital. As Mohammed Arif was making his way home, he was attacked. Eyewitnesses reported seeing the attacker hit Mohammed Arif with a stick, causing bloodshed on the pavement. A quote from a witness said, "There was blood all over the pavement." Now that can create quite a vivid image. Following the incident, police looked for a stolen microphone from a local concert, but later found it unrelated to the case. This could be perhaps they presumed it the bludgeoning weapon. Otherwise, no other information was on it, and it was dropped as unrelevant to the case. At the time, Detective Superintendent John Clark warned that the killer could strike again and appealed for local help in capturing the assailant, but no arrests were made. Nowadays, Mohammed Arif's murder remains unsolved, with the identity of his attackers still unknown. Maybe in the future, further information will be released, but as of right now, Mohammed Arif's murder remains unsolved.
How was Mohammed Arif regarded in his community?
There was no information on, you know, his characteristic traits or how he was perceived, but it could be assumed his Pakistani nationality was taken into account for his attackers.
If we think about
2025, right? Racial discrimination is also very big here as well. What is your take on this? What do you think the reason could be? Do you think it is for no reason, or could it be for a specific reason that's just not disclosed?
Based on, you know, the times of 1980 with immigration and all, it was a, let's say, dark time for, you know, people of other cultures. And unfortunately, people held a lot of hate for people of other nationalities. But it can't be presumed as the only reason, as realistically, it is an unsolved case. There is no clear answer to why.
My question to you guys, as we're talking about an incident that happened 45 years ago, is this the Nelson that you guys know now? Have things changed where, yeah, terrible incidents like this can happen? Or does it feel like it feels familiar to you?
Around here, I think that things have changed dramatically as well. There are a lot of ethnic minorities around here. Like, there's a lot of Muslims out here as well. I think there should be more equality around here. Like, everyone should be treated the same regardless of what their ethnic minority is and gender as well.
This incident happened at night. It happened in the dark. One thing that's come out of a lot of my work with young people around here is not a fear of the dark, but certainly a wariness of it, and it being a thing that holds them back from going out more into natural spaces or into spaces that aren't the town, that are not lit. Does any of that kind of resonate to your guys' experience?
So this is going to be taken into a little bit of a cultural aspect of it. So, for example, in the Pakistani culture, we have the, obviously there's the saying that men are men, like they're going to be men. And for the women, they're advised that once it gets a bit dark, so don't be leaving, because you don't, and no offense to any man, but like, you don't know what you're going to be kind of walking into. Now, you're going to be in a dark place, you're walking down, like, say, an alley, right? You don't know what the other person is thinking. They can come from behind, they can do whatever. Now, I guess in that fear of women growing up, in that fear that anything can happen in the dark, you don't know, and you can't say anything, especially because the cultural thing as well. It's like, you say something about it, it's gonna be technically your fault. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's, you can't even say anything because of, like, cultural respect and your father's respect or your family's respect. I think things that happen in the dark, they kind of just stay in the dark. Especially in, like, the Lancashire area that we live in, it's a lot of Pakistani, like, people in the community. And they kind of still have that mentality of, if anything happens to one of our daughters or mothers or sisters, it's not something we can tell anybody, because what are others going to say? Now, I think that's awful. I'm not for it at all. I'm like, I'm such a feminist type person. I'm like, you need to tell somebody, who gave them the right, this and that. But I guess because the cultural difference, it's just, it matters that things that happen in the dark stay in the dark. Now, bring it back to the murder or this unsolved mystery, it's kind of the same. What happened in the dark, stay in the dark. No one knows what happened. Maybe some people do know, but what will people say? Well, if there's a backstory to it and they're trying to hide it, what will people say?
I mean, people go on about a male loneliness epidemic, and I kind of get what they mean. Therapy was a godsend for me, because I think, had I not gone through that, I probably would fall under that category of the male loneliness epidemic, falling down that right-wing pipeline. But it does just come back to sort of taking accountability for your own actions and knowing that there's other people on the planet that just treat them how you'd want to be treated. And I don't get what the block is there. I don't know if there's some sort of lack of empathy that needs to be taught, or emotional maturity or something, but the lack of accountability is, I think, a big issue with a lot of things these days. I suppose it comes back to the self-preservation of humanity, innit? If you think you're a threat, then your guard's gonna be up and you're gonna be more sort of against sort of certain groups of people, where if you focus on what the actual isolated issue is, and you try and you just take it case by case, you don't tar it with the same brush as everything else.
I agree completely, 100%. So there was a study of it's a psychological study of women. So basically, we have the motherly instinct. So that does not only put in I guess you can say, just being the mother. It's more when you're in a surrounding. So this was in the study. They said when they're in a surrounding, they have a type of conscious sense when they feel like they're in a threat. Now, obviously, I'm talking as a Pakistani culture does not believe in that. It is not a thing. Now, in my personal experience, I know that I do get that sense when I feel like I'm in a little bit of danger. I get the sense at the back of my head, I need to get out of this place right now. And most of the time, I do. But there's sometimes where you can't, obviously, if you're walking home alone. I live in a very kind of dead area. When I'm walking home alone, I could feel like, okay, someone's staring at me. What am I going to do? There's that little voice in my head saying, you got to get your guards up, girl. So I genuinely want to know, do men have this sense in them that, I don't know, I feel like maybe I am feeling like I'm a danger towards someone. Maybe if this other person is feeling a threat towards me, what is it in me that I can change?
Until you know what you're actually doing and how that affects people, you don't really put much mind to it. But when you realize, you're like, oh my God. And I think, yeah, it really does come back to that sort of level of empathy and having that perspective and being able to see it from other people's points of view.
Going off about the idea of men being a perceived threat in a sense, I can sort of comment on that, as in I like to almost appear intimidating, not because I want to scare anyone in a sense that I want to harm them, but in a sense of self-preservation, that I don't want someone to think I'm an easy target. And I would believe maybe I could send the wrong message to some people, which in my heart, I don't want to do, but I feel with society, I have to have my guard up at all times, just in case, even as a male, because you never know what's around a corner. You never know who could attack you. You know, Mohammed Arif, he probably never knew. Maybe he did, but we never know.
I 100% agree with you, 100%. And I feel like from past situations for myself, I've also I had to put my guard up completely. I tried looking intimidating, I'm not an easy target, sweetheart. That's just how I am. Maybe I guess it's because I have men around me, obviously my brothers, my father. I kind of pick up from them. I'm more like a boy than I am more of a girl. But other than the fact that I understand that men have to always keep their guards up and everything like that, right? But I mean, personally, once you get to know somebody, I feel like you kind of get to know that obviously they're trying to put their guards up and all that, right? But the people you just don't know, and you're walking down an alley and there's just people around you and you feel like there's a threat. It's for example, even in your murder mystery, what if he was just walking, he felt the threat behind him? Maybe he didn't feel it, and then all of a sudden he's murdered. Nobody knows.
Can I ask you guys a question about how maybe you guys have experienced these themes of threat or danger or feeling unsettled or needing self-preservation? Do they ever occur in nature? Do they ever occur when you're out in a landscape, or is it a very different dynamic?
I wouldn't say that this happens early in the morning. If anybody wanted to go out into nature, I'd recommend early up in the morning, because obviously at night time, when you go to parks or stuff, you know, some people might want to do laps around the park. At night time, there is hardly any cameras. And, you know, there could be someone watching you from the other side. And obviously, you might feel it in your mind that there's somebody watching you, but you'd really don't want to turn back in case they might just start following you.
Okay, I agree with what he's saying, but even in the light,
even in the light,
things happen.
In daylight,
in I'm talking like, because I used to live, there used to be a graveyard behind my house. Now, at night, that graveyard used to go pitch black. The only lights you're going to see are the lights on the graves. Now, I still remember during the day, I had to go through it to go to school. And there was this weird house. It was an abandoned house. At the same time, I always had this thing that, you know what? My best safety is whenever I go through the graveyard, I'd FaceTime my father or my friends. And if they're on FaceTime with me, anything happens, they're with me. So I guess anything can happen at any time. It does not matter about like day or night. It's most likely to happen at night because people don't want to get caught. But especially in nature, and when you're like, obviously with the graveyard, there was like a whole woods, and there was a lot of, I guess, stories you can say about those specific woods, about women going into the graveyard to see family, or you know what I mean, and then just disappearing.
Is it something about these places on the edge of the town, going into nature, the graveyard, the woods, that feel a little bit more lawless or a little bit more lacking in rules or certainty, that, you know, that it's kind of these spaces for these stories to...
If I can bring it back to sort of the Pendle Witch Trials, that was one of King James's concerns about Lancashire, is that it was, in effect, lawless. There wasn't many big towns. It was little village communities. So it was essentially Wild West. But obviously when an area has that reputation, it can be easy for the people in that community to sort of try and live up to it, which you shouldn't try and do. If your area has a bad reputation, counteract the reputation and prove that it's wrong.
So when you speak about kind of uplifting your community, in a sense, building that positive image, how do you think people should go about that?
Just getting involved with the community, seeing who's actually out there. It's all right going on Facebook and saying, oh, these people are doing this, or this group is doing such thing. Right, get out in your community and find out for yourself. Don't take some headline's word for it. You know, meet the people, build those relationships and those connections, and, make your community better.
Make a change, yeah.
I suppose that shows here how we're all kind of gathered together in that sense. But also the other bit I'm going to, you know, discuss is running it back to, like, going out and having, you know, that, I suppose, identity of going out, like, when I was, like, being, you know, supposed a threat, in a sense, or having my guard up. So I have quite a rational fear of people, in a sense, because I'm always uncertain of how people are going to behave or act, and I'm also a little agoraphobic because of it, that fear of leaving the house in case something happens. And it has become quite a relevant fear to me, on the account as I do take medication for it. But it's, I suppose, building steps to getting over that fear, and hopefully threats, in a sense, so to speak, will not be present, but unfortunately they are. So a lot of people's fears do become quite realistic and rational, to, so to speak.
Yeah, I would say fear definitely grows in isolation when you're not given opportunities to connect with people. Yeah, definitely an issue, and something that will counteract it would be more community events. There's a lot of things we can connect on, you know, just like basic, maybe like cooking, outdoor events. Yeah, people usually, once they're isolated, it's easy to turn people against each other and make people see amplified differences, but people are a lot more similar than they are different. Thank you for joining our podcast. If you would like to learn more about the Yes Hub or the Are You Lost exhibition, you can find more information online.